The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at stories that have been the subject of some recent controversy. Molecular pharmacologist David Kroll returns to the show to tell us about the possible connection between high caffeine energy drinks and a handful of deaths in the U.S. and Canada. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to University of Alberta physicist James Pinfold about some new experiments casting doubt on a popular theory in particle physics. And we're joined by Joel Baum, Director of Education and Training at Gender Spectrum, to talk about the sometimes simplistic ways that society views gender. Enjoy. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and I'm here with David J. Kroll. David is a molecular cancer pharmacologist and the Science Communications Director at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and that's in Raleigh. He also writes the fabulous science blog, Take As Directed, which was recently picked up by Forbes.com. David, wonderful to have you back.
It's great to be here, as always. Thanks for having me.
So the reason why I wanted to have you on the show is something that I really want to talk about. I'm glad you wrote a post on this. It was on the Forbes blog, and it was called What You Really Need to Know About the Safety of 5-Hour Energy. So I guess the first question I have, this is mostly for the audience, for the uninitiated, what is 5-Hour Energy?
So 5-Hour Energy is it's a concentrated version of those energy drinks that you see in the coolers at your convenience stores as you stop for gas. And what this is it's a concentrated version that's sold not in the coolers, but it's right up there at the cashier's desk. And the advertisement with this product is that you don't have to drink these tremendous amounts of syrupy, high sugar, high calorie drinks to get your caffeine. Here you just get a shot of some amount of caffeine without having to bring in all those extra calories.
So basically it is like a caffeine booster for people who don't like coffee or don't like calories.
Don't like coffee or don't like the bulk, the sugar, or actually the taste of those energy drinks. I don't personally find them terribly pleasant myself.
They're vile. And the reason that I wanted to do this segment so badly is because, full disclosure, I actually drink those 5-hour energies. So I'm going to learn a lot here.
Good for you. You're traveling across large expanses of the prairie and the Rocky Mountains, I understand.
Thank you, sir. So why are they in the news lately?
They're in the news lately because of reports, both in the United States and in Canada, about caffeine toxicity. That is, the federal regulatory authorities, here is the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, have received numerous reports where people have died after drinking 5-hour energy drink or have become hospitalized. Now, this is just simply an association. People who were hospitalized, people who passed on, had drunk 5-hour energy drinks sometime previous to their demise. But the symptoms and the medical descriptions of what happened in each of these cases seem to be so similar that the Food and Drug Administration felt it was necessary to notify consumers about the potential risks. And it wasn't just with 5-hour energy drink. It was also with the conventional energy drinks like Rockstar, Monster, and in Canada, it was Red Bull.
We should say right up front, though, and you sort of touched on that, the reports that we've seen so far aren't nearly enough to prove that an energy drink killed anyone, right?
No, that's the important point. These are just kind of reports that where there's enough numbers of associations that have popped up that regulatory authorities just want to put out some news. But there is by no means at all a direct association, a direct causal link between drinking these things and having heart problems, heart attacks, convulsions, or even death. So don't worry yet.
Yet. Thank you. But you do mention specifically in your post that one ingredient in the artificial sweetener that might explain some of the symptoms. And I'm going to let you pronounce it because I will murder it.
Oh, sure. So you're talking about phenylalanine, which is an amino acid that that makes up the artificial sweetener aspartame. It's also put in there as the free amino acid, allegedly to increase energy. And one of the problems with phenylalanine is that some people, about one in every 15,000, are born with a genetic disorder that restricts their ability to actually metabolize phenylalanine normally. And these people have a disorder called phenylketonuria, or just PKU for short. What happens, though, is folks are screened for this at birth. And so if you have this phenylalanine intolerance, you'll probably know about it, and you'll probably avoid foods that are high in this amino acid. So that's the reason when you pick up a diet soda or any drink using aspartame, it will say, warning, phenylketonuric contains phenylalanine. And that never used to mean anything to me until I learned about phenylketonuria. When I wrote this post, Desiree, I thought that this was a huge problem. And a couple commenters in the medical field said to me that people with PKU are so vigilant about what's in their diet that it's highly, highly unlikely that whatever side effects we're seeing with 5-hour energy result from phenylalanine. It probably is due more to the caffeine content, if, again, there is a causal relationship.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with David Kroll, author of the blog Take As Directed at Forbes.com. We're talking about what we know and what we don't about the safety of popular energy drinks. So again, full disclosure, and anybody who has ever met me in real life, I love coffee. I always have a cup, always, unless I'm sleeping. So you actually make the case that there are reasons to be cautious about caffeine.
Long before we had energy drinks, I think there are always reasons to be cautious with one's caffeine intake. Caffeine, even though it's a naturally occurring chemical that, you know, you find it in cocoa, you find it in coffee, just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's 100% safe. And there's been increasing numbers of publications showing that caffeine at concentrations that we would drink actually can increase your blood pressure. Now, for most of us, that's not a problem. But if you already have high blood pressure or are predisposed to heart problems with the rhythm at which your heart beats, caffeine and too much caffeine can be a problem. But by and large, most of the coffee that we drink will normally have nowhere more than about 100 milligrams, 150 milligrams of caffeine. Your average soda, your average Coke or Pepsi or Mountain Dew will contain anywhere between 35 and 55 milligrams of caffeine. So the question is, how much do these energy drinks contain? And it really runs across the board, but they can contain as much as 200, 300, even 400 milligrams of caffeine. So you're getting in these energy drinks pretty much about 2-3 cups of average coffee. And we can talk about Starbucks and other gourmet coffees in a minute if you'd like.
Well, you might as well.
I might as
well. We're talking about my favorite subject. So everything you say right now that stops short of "it will kill you now," I'm open to.
So I didn't realize this until the a different analytical chemistry lab started looking at coffee that was brewed, you know, say at McDonald's versus at a multinational coffee chain like Starbucks. Turns out that Starbucks, a grande, which is a large in normal language, a grande coffee at Starbucks can contain about 300 milligrams of caffeine. And in fact, it can vary between like 250 and 564 milligrams, depending on how it's brewed. That is mainlining caffeine. It's a huge, huge amount. And in all seriousness, you know, the general number that people use is that 400 milligrams is probably the upper limit of what anybody, any adult, should be drinking. And even at that concentration, you'll see increases in blood pressure. So while we say these energy drinks have high amounts of caffeine, well, not compared to Starbucks coffee.
That makes me feel better-ish.
Right. So, and what that also would tell me is that no person should be drinking more than one grande Starbucks coffee a day.
Well, and this is what I'm wondering. You mentioned in your post that that caffeine is only regulated by the FDA as a food additive in the U.S., and it's on something called the generally regarded as safe list. So do you think that should be changed to something with a, I don't know, a stronger warning?
Boy, I'm not a regulatory person, but and I really hate to see, you know, new laws being enacted when we really don't know exactly how dangerous these high levels of caffeine are across populations of millions, you know, of consumers. So caffeine had been on this federal regulatory list called Generally Recognized as Safe, or the GRAS list. And this list, which is, you know, held by the Food and Drug Administration in the states, says that any chemicals in food products that have been, you know, used safely for centuries, decades, so forth, the chemicals in them are generally safe at the concentrations or at the portion sizes that you would normally take them in at. Of course, this list came about before we had energy drinks and before we had essentially a culture where we tried to enrich our products with more of a chemical. In that, you know, if a little is good, more has to be better. And so the question today is caffeine as safe as perhaps maybe caffeinated products were back, you know, in the 1950s when this list was originally made? The question is, should there be heavier regulations or laws governing, you know, caffeine labeling or caffeine distribution? And I think normally what we see now is that energy drinks have to list the amount of caffeine they contain. But that I don't think that really helps the regular consumer, you know, who does, well, if this has 250 milligrams of caffeine, is that a lot? Is that too little? And of course, the regulatory authorities don't want to say exactly how much is safe. They don't even want to go as far as saying that, you know, 4 milligrams per kilogram of body weight is about the limit of what you should be taking. And for me, I hate to say I'm pushing 100 kilograms. That would be 400 milligrams for 4 times 100. So the problem with the 5-hour energy was that they do not list the amount of caffeine at all anywhere right. in the bottle. And that, I think, if anything, is going to get them in trouble if these deaths and hospitalizations are indeed due to the high caffeine in there. And just so you know, the amount was measured by Consumers Union, the nonprofit that runs Consumer Reports, and they calculated that 5-hour energy contains 215 milligrams in that 2.5 2-ounce serving. What was interesting, though, is when Consumer Reports tested the extra strength 5-hour energy, it only contained a few more milligrams, 242. So don't buy the extra strength.
So I guess the biggest question then is there any reason to expect that the caffeine in a shot like 5-hour energy is riskier than another drink?
This my answer will be only hypothetical, but it makes good scientific sense, and that is caffeine by itself is normally a diuretic. That is it's like a medicine that causes you to excrete water, to urinate out water, and what that can do is it can dehydrate you, and it can also cause you to have imbalances of things in your bloodstream like sodium and potassium, things that we need for our hearts to beat normally. With energy drinks, say you get the same amount of caffeine as in 5-Energy, but it's liquid that's about 16 fluid ounces, or, you know, 350. What do you say in Canada? 350 liters. You've got a lot of that extra liquid coming into your body. I think the problem with the 5-hour energy, if there is indeed a problem, is that you're getting all that caffeine with a very small amount of liquid. And I think you can get dehydrated very quickly if you take several of these 5-hour energy doses or shots. And I think the effect of that will really depend on your pre-existing condition. Are you a normal, healthy, you know, 21-year-old, or you are you somebody who has a history of heart conditions, who has a family history of rhythm disturbances in your heart? You know, and I should mention, this doesn't necessarily have to do only with whether your perception is being young and healthy. We've had cases in Canada where people have died from Red Bull, where they were 16 or 18 years old and they had an undiagnosed cardiac rhythm problem. So, you know, it's consumer beware when you look at these caffeine drinks. But then again, it's consumer beware with almost every consumer product you take. Anytime you release a product to a population of tens or hundreds of millions of people with all kinds of genetic backgrounds, you're bound to have some untoward side effects that are going to occur. It's just simple statistics, simple math.
Well, that's somewhat reassuring. Thank you, David. And thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I need to point out, if caffeine ever does become a controlled substance, it's going to be some problems. That's all I'm saying. You'll find a link to David Kroll's blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with guest host Rochelle Saunders and particle physicist James Pinfold right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm Rochelle Saunders, sitting in the host chair today for regular Skeptically Speaking host Desiree Schell. Today I'm here with Dr. James Pinfold, professor of physics at the University of Alberta and a visiting professor at King's College London. He's currently the spokesperson for the METAL LHC experiment, co-spokesman of the SLIM astroparticle experiment in Bolivia, and a founding member of the ATLAS LHC collaboration at CERN that recently observed the new particle that may just be the Higgs boson. Welcome to the show, James.
Hello.
This last year has been a pretty exciting one in the area of particle physics, with some great ups and downs, and more recently the news of the possible discovery of the Higgs boson particle. But what I'd like to talk about are some of the things that have flown in under the radar this year while neutrinos and Higgs bosons were in the limelight. And one of them is something that's actually more about what we haven't been able to find or see, perhaps disconfirming a theory rather than confirming one, something that doesn't usually get any press at all. And this year, the supersymmetry theory has really come under scrutiny. So to start, let's talk about the standard model in physics.
Yes. Okay. So the standard model has three generations of quarks and leptons. So in the lowest generation, we have the up and down quark that make up the matter as we know it, and the electron and the electron neutrino. In the second generation, you have got the strange and the charm quark. And then you have the muon and the muon neutrino in the third generation. It's only just got filled out in the last century. In the end of the last century, you have the top and the bottom quark and the tau neutrino. Now, there are four fundamental forces, and the force carriers are, in the case of the strong interaction, the gluons, the eight gluons. In the case of the weak interaction, the W plus and W minus bosons and the Z boson. And in the case of the electromagnetic force, it's the photon that's a carrier. And of course, if you want gravity in there, which is not in the standard model, I might add, then you would need a graviton as the exchange particle. There are lots of problems with the standard model, though, and we don't think it's the most fundamental theory. Do you want me to go into those?
Yeah, it would be great to hear what some of the problems are with the standard model and why you're looking for a theory that's more specific or that will fill some of those gaps.
I mean, the first problem with the standard model is there are 21 free parameters that we have to put in by hand. And of course, if you can think of the standard model as a radio for listening to God, then it shouldn't have 21 free parameters. It shouldn't have 21 knobs to twiddle.
Right.
So we think maybe one or two, or maybe just an on-off switch. So that's one problem. I think another problem is that we know that a lot of matter, say, if all the matter in the universe, only 4% is visible, and something like 24%, 4 to 5%, and something like 24% is dark matter. And there is no natural candidate for dark matter in the standard model. That's another problem with the standard model. Yet another problem is that one would expect that the running of the coupling constants as they run with energy, that at some stages you run them to higher and higher energies, in other words, back in time towards the birth of the universe, that they would meet at one point. That's the unification of those forces, and they don't. And I think the third and most interesting problem from the point of view of this interview is the fact that it's a hierarchy problem. And the hierarchy problem, there's a weak hierarchy problem. There's also the problem with the Higgs, mass. And I'll just quickly go through those. So we know the fundamental energy. We believe the fundamental energy scale of physics, the Planck scale, is a scale set by gravity. The question is, why is gravity so weak compared to the other forces? That's called the weak hierarchy problem. However, a more technical problem that I think is really concerning us is that quantum mechanics makes the standard model unstable. Quantum mechanics teaches us that as a particle, the Higgs boson travels along, it can emit and reabsorb another particle. And in fact, all of the standard model particles. And this process represents something called a loop contribution to the mass of the Higgs boson. That's just because of the pictorial way it's represented by Feynman diagrams when you do the calculations. Unfortunately, when you add up all these contributions to the Higgs boson mass from all possible particles and all possible energies and momentum, they appear to be infinite, or at least proportional to the maximum possible momentum that can be carried. So this is called the Higgs fine chain. The only way you can get them to be non-infinite is to arrange very, very accurate fine-tuning cancellations. The supersymmetry, which posits partner particle to every single standard model particle, allows you to naturally cancel these contributions and make the Higgs mass final and stable at a certain value.
So supersymmetry is sort of a search for stability in the standard model in a lot of cases.
Well, I think supersymmetry gives you this Higgs, a nice stable Higgs mass, and cancels the contributions to the Higgs mass that would otherwise drive the Higgs mass to infinity or to very large values, should we say.
Right.
So according to supersymmetry, each fermion is paired with a more massive supersymmetric boson, and each boson with a fermionic super sibling. So, for example, the electron has the selectron, a boson, as its supersymmetric particle, while the photon is partnered with the photino, a fermion. And in fact, the standard joke is, yes, we've discovered supersymmetry because we see half the particles, of course, that are the standard model particles.
Right.
So, we need that supersymmetric cancellation to get the Higgs mass down to its value of, should we say, 125, if we are indeed seeing a Higgs boson at the HC.
So what experiments are testing for this, and how do they work?
The two main experiments that are looking, there are three experiments, and I'll tell you the latest result probably has just only come out, and you may not know about it, but there are two experiments looking for evidence for supersymmetry, and they are CMS and the ATLAS experiment at the LHC. And they look for evidence of supersymmetry, particularly in when there's massive missing energy. And that missing energy is due to the lightest supersymmetric particle, which is the neutralino. And that neutralino doesn't leave any evidence in the detectors. It streams out of the detectors. And so you look for missing energy plus jets and leptons to give you your evidence for supersymmetry. And of course, you expect if you expect if the supersymmetric particles are below, say, a TV scale, you expect to see a lot of evidence for this. You hope to see a lot of evidence. We haven't seen that evidence yet. I don't think that's the end of supersymmetry, by the way, because there are lots of places in supersymmetric parameter space. There's some in supersymmetry, there are about 123 parameters, and you can adjust the parameters across a wide range. And I think the rumors of SUSY's death, supersymmetry's death, have been greatly exaggerated, to paraphrase Mark Twain. So it's still a lot of room for supersymmetry. It's still hanging in there. A very recent result from LHCb looks at supersymmetry in a new way. It looks for in the decay of a bottom meson called the B sub S, which is a meson which is comprised of an anti B quark and a strange quark. And supersymmetry should add to its decays to a certain rare final state, which is the mu plus and the mu minus. So standard model gives a prediction for that decay, but if it's bigger than that, for example, enhanced, then it could be due to supersymmetry. But latest results show there's no evidence for any supersymmetric enhancement of that final state. That just came out in November, and that was reported by a third LHC experiment called LHCb, which concentrates on the B physics at the LHC. So all in all, though, you can say that what this does is reduce the wiggle room, but there is still a lot of wiggle room for supersymmetry, and there's still a lot of places for supersymmetry to hide. So in fact, this is pushing the mass of the supersymmetric particles up when we don't see them at this lower energy of this lower and this, well, I think the luminosity is kind of high now, but at this lower energy. We expect then maybe to see them at higher energy. So I think it's really up in the ante for the next phase of the LHC, which will happen after this long shutdown that's coming up. The LHC will shut down, and when it opens up again, it will open up at the new higher energy of 13 to 14 TeV as a central mass energy. And of course, all hopes will then go to looking at this higher mass with more luminosity and looking to see if supersymmetry is slightly heavier than we probably hoped it would be.
So if it is slightly heavier and we do find evidence for that, what are the implications for the supersymmetry theory? Are they significant? Does it have to change significantly from sort of the elegant theory that it is now? Or is it kind of minor adjustments?
I think you can probably deal with it. Of course, if the supersymmetric particles, the squarks and the gluinos and so on, if they're heavier, if they're too heavy, then it starts to interfere with this lovely property that they can cancel these infinities, shall we say, cancel these diagrams in the Higgs mass. In other words, we start to have to fine-tune again to get rid of the problems. And fine-tuning is reckoned to be a bad thing. In other words, you shouldn't have to twiddle with things so that they cancel out exactly to give you the right answer. It should happen sort of naturally in the theory.
Right.
A theoretical explanation. And if those particles are too massive, then it interferes with this problem, with this nice property that you don't have to have fine-tuning. I think another thing is if you believe that dark matter comes from supersymmetric particles, shall we say the neutralino, then if the particles are too heavy, it starts to interfere with the ability of supersymmetry to explain dark matter in a simple way. Of course, all of this there are lots of ways for theoreticians to wiggle around, and there's no categorical statement you can make here.
So when it comes to supersymmetry, how many other sort of theories that will solve some of the problems in the standard model are out there? Are there other ones that we're exploring as well?
Yes, there are technicolor theories. There are theories of extra dimensions. Technicolor posits a new force called technicolor, and has new particles that can do the cancellations and so on. You have theories of extra dimensions as a two main other theories, along with supersymmetry. I think supersymmetry is the one where theoreticians have put most work, but there are now two other possibilities that are common. Again, theories of extra dimensions and say, technicolor. Now, of course, technicolor has the problem that it doesn't have a Higgs. We've just seen one, maybe, but we don't know we've seen one yet. we have to wait maybe for a few months more, maybe 6 months, a year, to really know this is a Higgs boson.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and today we're diving into the world of cutting-edge particle physics with Dr. James Pinfold, professor of physics and spokesperson for the METAL experiment at the Large Hadron Collider. So what is the METAL project?
Well, METAL's the latest LHC experiment. It's one of the smaller experiments. It's a David to the LHC Goliaths, and it's designed to search for new physics via the avatars of highly ionizing particles. And the new physics it's looking for are, say, magnetic monopoles. That's evidence of magnetic charge. It's also looking for massive stable particles. It could be supersymmetric particles. They could be particles from extra dimensions and so on. And what it's doing is it's expanding the physics reach of the LHC in a complementary way, because this is the kind of particle it's not easy for the main experiments to see. It's due to run officially when we start up again after the long shutdown, as I said, in 2015. That's when the long shutdown ends and we start to take data. But we've already started to deploy test detectors, so we expect to get first data out in, say, 2013.
So what is a magnetic monopole?
Well, this is a very interesting idea. So we all know that you can get a positive and a negative charge. And Dirac was the first person to say you could actually get, say, a north pole charge and a south pole charge. You can get independent magnetic charge, just as, in a way, cutting a magnet into two. But, of course, we all know if we cut a magnet into two, we just get two magnets. And if we cut it again, we get four magnets and so on. But Dirac in 1930 came up with a way to actually get a single magnetic charge. And of course, if we found this, it would revolutionize physics. And it's not something that's currently a main emphasis for the LHC detectors, but I would say that a discovery of the magnetic monopole would probably be more revolutionary than anything else we're likely to find at the LHC. But I'm biased, but I think it's equally as revolutionary as anything we are likely to see at the LHC that's new.
So how would the discovery of this, what would the ramifications be here for physics?
Well, of course, it would we don't at the moment believe there is independent magnetic charge. So if we can make it at the LHC, then of course there must have been magnetic charge at the birth of the universe, which is not, I mean, and of course we have theories that actually predict there was magnetic charge at the birth of the universe, but it would be very, very heavy. So some stage in the universe's development, the magnetic monopole must have played its role. So it would essentially alter everything. Something that wasn't expected to exist would have to be brought into all of the equations. So it would be, in fact, revolutionary. Whereas, for example, the Higgs boson, if it is a standard model Higgs boson, was expected.
So these are experiments that actually haven't been run yet that are planning to be run, is that correct?
The METAL experiment is planning to run in the year 2015 after the long shutdown. We're preparing for it now. We're starting to build it. But we already deployed test detectors at the LHCb intersection region. So we share the same intersection region with the LHCb detector that I told you about previously. And so we do expect to get some results from these test detectors out before we actually officially start.
So have you seen anything from them yet, or you're still in the process of gathering data?
We're sort of deploying the detectors and building the detectors. They go in probably 2013. We have some detectors deployed. They're totally different than the usual detectors you see at the LHC. They're passive detectors. So essentially, we are surrounding the LHCb intersection region, or point 8 on the LHC ring, with a photographic film that can only photograph new physics. And then we take that film out after a year, and then we develop it, so to speak, to look for the image of new physics in this new film. We also do something else. We have detectors that can trap these particles, literally trap in the detector. And we can take those trapping detectors out and analyze them for evidence of new physics. So it's a totally new way of looking for physics at the LHC, which usually uses electronic detectors that simply measure in real time, so to speak.
So this isn't just the discovery of potentially new physics, but also the use of some completely new technology to try and find it.
It's technology that's been used before in this area, but this is the first massive use of passive detector technology at the LHC, and the only one that I know of, and the biggest use of it. And I think it's the first time that people have used trapping detectors in the way that we've used them, so that we can actually capture the particle, so to speak. For example, if we capture a magnetic monopole in this detector, we can actually then go and look to see for evidence of its magnetic field emanating from the detector, using something called a SQID. So a way of detecting very small magnetic fields. And we can also look for the decays of particles. Massive particles get trapped in the detector. And we plan to do that by deploying them underground, for example, at SNOLAB, and then looking for the decays of these particles with time. So we have ways to actually trap these detectors, as well as to gain evidence for their existence. And even when we take the, say, photographs of these particles, we'd have a permanent record. Whereas, of course, in the LHC detectors, they just have a transient flash of electronic signals that they interpret at a later they interpret in their data analysis. But we'd actually have hard copy, so to speak.
So are there any current physics theories, for example, supersymmetry or maybe string theory, that actually predict the magnetic monopole?
Yeah, so the grand unified theories predict the monopole, a lot of them. In fact, it was a reason for the theory of inflation, because they predict so many monopoles, you had to come up with an explanation of why they're not a problem. For example, at the birth of the universe, you have something called the monopole problem, and that's why Guth came up with this theory of inflation. Of course, string theory and M theory predict monopoles. So all the modern theories predict most of them. Well, it's all of them, I can't say that, but most of the modern theories do have monopole solutions or dyon solutions. Dyons having electric and magnetic charge. So magnetic charge is definitely there according to the theories. Now, it could be so heavy we can't detect it at the LHC, but of course it could be light too, and it's important to look for this particle. If we did find it, as say, it would be a revolutionary, paradigm-shifting discovery.
So if we do find it, is this potentially a step forward for something like string theory?
It's certainly I think it would be a step forward for string theory. I think it would give a valuable piece of information. And as I say, it will tell us a lot about the universe in its early stages as well, because at the moment, there isn't really room for a monopole that we can detect at the LHC. There's room for these very, very heavy monopoles, the gut monopoles, as they're called, that are much too massive for us to detect. But if we actually detect a monopole, I think it would just about change everything. We'd even have to go back and change textbooks at university and even schools, because it's said there that there's no such thing as free magnetic charge. And, of course, it isn't true. You know, they say, well, we can get independent positive and electric and positive and negative electric charges, but we can only have sort of dipoles when it comes to magnets with a north and a south pole. We can't have them separate. But in principle, we would prove that's wrong. So it would be a fundamental sea change for physics. I think we'd have to go back and rethink even the elementary textbooks.
Well, I will be anxiously awaiting 2015 and beyond to find out how these experiments go. Thank you so much for being with us here today, James.
Bye-bye.
If you want to learn more about Dr. James Pinfold and his work, you can visit skepticallyspeaking.com, where a link to his websites will be available in our show notes.
After the break, we'll talk about gender expression and societal labels with Joel Baum, Director of Education and Training at Gender Spectrum. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at one of the biggest science stories of 2012 and one of the largest instruments in history. Guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan spends the hour with theoretical physicist Sean Carroll, author of the new book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. They'll discuss the search for the particle that gives all the others their mass, the story of the Large Hadron Collider, and the challenge of communicating with a broad audience about difficult topics in cutting-edge physics. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Joel Baum. Joel is the Director of Education and Training at Gender Spectrum, an organization that works to provide education, resources, and support to help create a gender-sensitive and inclusive environment for all children and teens. He's also a professor of educational leadership at California State University, East Bay, a member of the Child and Adolescent Gender Center, and a member of the World Professional Association for Transgendered Health. Now, before we start, I want to take a minute to just explain why we're talking about this topic. Back in episode 189, we interviewed Simon LeVay, a pioneer in the study of the biological aspects of sexual orientation and the author of the book Gay, Straight, and the Reason Why. Now, that interview generated some discussion. So after some listener comments, we realized that we might not have as much knowledge as we'd like about the nuance of gender, sexuality, and the most respectful ways to discuss those complicated topics. So we've invited Joel here to help us learn more about how to do that and to tell us how Gender Spectrum is trying to encourage a safe and inclusive environment for children and teens across a whole range of genders. Thanks for being here, Joel.
Great. Thank you.
So the first thing I want to do is distinguish between two terms that are sometimes used interchangeably but don't exactly mean the same thing. So what do you see as the difference between gender and sex?
Great. No, that's an important place to start. So for a lot of people, they're used interchangeably, and that can be fine for a lot of people. When individuals are born, based on their genitalia, they're assigned a sex. For many people, that automatically becomes their gender, and for many people that works quite well. However, sex, or the biological component of gender, is only one element that really creates an individual's authentic gender. And so in the work that we do, training educators, students, and other organizations or individuals, we talk about a model called the dimensions of gender that recognizes other aspects such as gender expression and gender identity in thinking about one's gender. Really, sex refers to the body. Gender refers to a whole complex interaction between one's body, one's gender expression, and one's gender identity.
But a lot of us are socialized from a very young age to see gender as a binary concept. There are boys and there are girls, and that would be it, basically. But that is not the way that people work, correct?
Right. That is absolutely not the way it works. What we have to recognize is that binary concept of gender does work for a lot of people. But like any majority group, the assumption that the dominant experience is the only experience is just simply inaccurate. We know that for a lot of people, gender is much more flexible than that simple A-B night and day binary.
Just to sort of add to that, in fact, isn't biological sex, that's not really dichotomous as well, is it?
That's exactly right. We know that while a lot of people are born with bodies that are called female and others are born with bodies that are called male, there are a host of naturally occurring variations on that theme. Currently, the nomenclature is DSDs, that is disorders of sexual development. These used to be conditions that were called intersex conditions, and even prior to that, hermaphroditic conditions. The upshot of it is that while there are a lot of bodies that come in one form or the other, there are some bodies, naturally occurring variations, that are neither typically male nor typically female. And if we're going to have a model for gender, it better be a model that incorporates the experiences of everyone and not just the majority.
Well, so maybe now let's talk about some specific terms and, in addition, maybe some ways that we can replace outdated or offensive terminology when we're talking about this subject. So maybe let's start with sort of a baseline. For most people, their biological sex will line up fairly well with their gender identity, right?
That's correct.
But using the word normal for that, that is problematic. Or even something like standard is problematic.
I would agree. I mean, when we use terms like normal or standard, we are creating what is essentially a correct way to be, and anything that varies from that is considered incorrect. And so what we like to talk about is there are some genders that are more commonly experienced than others, and some are less commonly experienced, but none are abnormal or incorrect. We really like to emphasize that each person, when you think about the complexity of gender, is more likely pretty unique than representing any one group or other group.
So where does the term cisgendered come from?
That's a great question. So cisgendered, the root word cis literally means on the same side. And so, for instance, I became first familiar with that term in chemistry when we talked about cis or trans compounds. And these are simply molecules that are cis compounds where the functional group is on the same side as the organic group versus a trans compound where they're opposite one another. A cisgendered person is an individual who essentially their gender expression, their gender identity, and their gender biology are aligned or typical.
Now, related to the way that the terms gender and sex are often used interchangeably to their detriment, the words transgender and transsexual are also confused a lot. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and let me just say, when we start getting into terminology, this is a very, very much an evolving aspect. And really what becomes essential is that we recognize that the way I might define that might be very different from the way someone else defines it. And when we're talking about definitions and ways of describing identity, what really matters is the person who is identifying themselves will determine what that term will mean for them. So for instance, transgender is frequently seen as an umbrella term that represents any individual who strays from the typical binary understandings of gender. Okay, so that could encompass anyone who has a gender identity that doesn't match their biology, but it can also include individuals who perhaps just express gender in a way that's different than expected. In other words, it's a whole range of individuals. When we use the term transgender, however, we try to use it in a much more precise way, which really is related to cisgender, and instead use a variety of other terms to represent anyone sort of in between those spaces. So for instance, terms like genderqueer or gender independent or gender expansive are some terms I've heard individuals use to describe individuals who are neither typically male nor female, but in fact exist somewhere in between. My understanding is the term transsexual is frequently used to specifically refer to an individual who has modified their body in some way. But I can also tell you, I know a number of individuals who will identify as transsexual who, in fact, have not modified their bodies in any way. And there are obviously lots of transgender people who have that don't necessarily use the term transsexual. You know, gender spectrum's work, as I've mentioned, is really focused on issues related to gender as they relate to all children and teens. We tend to avoid using the term transsexual when referring to children and teens because the vast majority of young people are not, in fact, altering their body, but instead are simply trying to assert a gender identity that is more consistent with their own sense of self. It becomes very complicated when we strive to define the experience of other people. And I would argue that that's where we really run into trouble, is this need to somehow define other people's experiences rather than letting them describe their own experiences and then believing them when they do.
So are we getting too caught up then in the precision of language sometimes?
Well, I think that's a great question because obviously language is one of the ways in which we make meaning of our world. But I don't think there's a problem with getting caught up with language. I think there's a problem that develops when we try to assign our language to other people rather than letting other people describe their own understandings of these terms. So even when someone says they're a boy or a girl, and someone else says they're a boy or a girl, I'm imagining that they may actually have similar, though by no means identical, definitions of those terms. Similarly, for some of these complex concepts that you're talking about here. And so part of the conversation is not just simply, oh, let's use words and make assumptions we all mean the same thing, but instead, let's operate from a shared set of understandings about the terms we're about to use. And so when we do work in schools, we definitely present the idea that these are terms that we use for the purposes of educating others and to allow us to engage in conversation about our practice and support for young people. We're not claiming to have the inside track on all the quote-unquote correct ways to use these words, although we do strive to be as respectful and consistent as possible.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Joel Baum, Director of Education and Training at Gender Spectrum. We're talking about the ways society views gender and how it differs from the reality of gender for individuals. So I don't want this to be a big vocabulary lesson this segment, but then if we shouldn't be focusing on the precision of language, that does make it difficult when, as the show that Simon LeVay was on, when we're talking about scientific studies in this area.
That's exactly right. We actually had the privilege of participating in the Institute of Medicine study of the disparities in healthcare for LGBT communities, and were asked specifically to speak to the experiences of children and youth within that context. And several of the researchers who were part of that committee expressed that same frustration. Much research is designed around counting things, and those things need to be defined. And yet we're dealing with a field in which those definitions are definitely moving targets. And it does make those kinds of conversations more challenging.
I don't know if this is exactly related, but I'm curious, since you do work with children and youth, do you think there's any kind of standard, and I'm using air quotes here that you can't see, relationship between biological sex and gender expression? Or is that just something that's unique to each person?
You know, I think there, in my experience, and I'm also a parent who has two children to include in my data set, but my experience is there are patterns of behavior. And so when a family talks about, well, I have a boy-boy or a typical girl, all I know is that there seem to be some patterns where certain dispositions seem to be more consistent with one biological sex than others. In my observations, there appears to be a difference in the way that many boys play and many girls play, for instance. There seems to be some differences in the way boys and girls tend to learn. That said, those patterns aren't rules. And that, to me, is the key in this work, is recognizing that while there are some patterns, there are variations to those patterns, and those variations need to not be seen as incorrect or somehow pathological, but instead naturally occurring variations that our cultures need to be comfortable with and recognize.
So then there are so many ways that we can talk about this. So what would your advice be then to, well, I guess to a whole group of people, to scientists or to parents or just to people who want to make sure that when they're having these discussions, they're not doing it in an offensive way?
You know, I think what first becomes important is that these conversations start by recognizing that there is a lot of confusion between notions of biological sex and gender. And so in the trainings that we do, one of the things we really try to emphasize is that it's important to operate from a framework in which you recognize gender is not simply biology, gender is not binary, and additionally, that gender is not sexual orientation. And if we can start with those two understandings, that can really help us come back to explain the experiences of individuals that we're trying to describe and discuss. And so I would encourage those conversations to start with a recognition and acceptance of that as part of the terms of engagement in the conversation.
So then how do you do all this in Gender Spectrum?
Well, so Gender Spectrum works in a lot of different ways. One of the things we do is provide a lot of direct services to families through consultations, family support groups. We also have an annual family conference each summer that brings together hundreds of families and young people and professionals to learn and support one another. And then a whole separate arm of our organization is focused on education and training efforts. Many of those take place in school settings as well as other professional institutions. And we really begin at the beginning. Many of our trainings begin by asking people, you know, what is the first question we typically ask someone when a baby is born or when they have a baby? And of course, the common question is, well, what'd you have? Did you have a boy or a girl? And we begin there by pointing out, well, how is that designation made? Well, it's made with genitalia. And for a lot of people, how that seems to work real well, but it turns out it doesn't work for everyone. And then from there, we build an understanding of the differences, coming back to what we talked about earlier, the naturally occurring variation simply in the biological aspects of gender. But then we also introduce the dimensions of gender expression and gender identity, and point out how, particularly with young people, gender is much more focused on gender expression. And much of the harassment and interaction kids have with each other is around gender expression. So that is, you know, is a boy or girl performing, quote unquote, the way they're supposed to as a boy or a girl? And we know from the research that, unfortunately, a lot of the mistreatment of young people is, in fact, grounded in gender. And finally, we then help people understand the notion of gender identity, this internal, deeply held sense of self that, again, rather than being binary, is a spectrum or a continuum. And if you imagine those as three different dimensions that when they intersect each other, they actually create three dimensions of space, you can suddenly see that there is a literally infinite number of variations on this theme.
So then do you work with individual families, or is this solely institutional?
No, we do a lot of work with individual families, and sometimes that work starts in that same place, because many of these families will have a child who is perhaps articulating a sense of self that's different than their assigned gender, and these families have often a gut instinct to want to support them in a culture that is telling them that they shouldn't. And so they often will contact us seeking some affirmation that, A, they're not crazy, and B, it seems like my child's a lot happier when I follow their lead rather than put them into some sort of binary box. And a lot of our work ends up being supporting families to simply relax and let their child take the lead here. You don't need to make a lot of decisions when you have a child who's articulating something about their gender that may be surprising. We know that you cannot make a child have a gender identity different than what they have. What we know you can do, however, is make them very unhappy about that gender identity by stigmatizing them, criticizing them, or in some other way, pushing them into a box that may not fit.
So where do we go from here, sir? Like, I assume this is getting better.
I would say that there are some things improving. I can tell you that when we do trainings at schools, the most difficult part of that work is working with the adults. Adults have a very difficult time understanding gender diversity and being comfortable with young people charting their own paths with regard to gender. At the same time, young people, as they are exposed to information about the diversity of gender, are much more capable of being accepting with one another. Even as we have statistics that show transgender kids in particular having very difficult times in many of our schools, our experience is that as soon as some education and training takes place, you can see a significant shift in the culture of a school or institution with regard to that, and that shift begins with the kids. And the younger the kids, the more flexible their thinking is in being able to simply accept another kid expressing their truth. And I think part of that's related to children just having a fundamental appreciation for simply being yourself. Most kids get that. And when they see another child simply trying to do the same thing, there's a natural affinity, I think.
That's lovely, sir. And Joel, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this very important work. Let me just finish by encouraging the adults out there who are responsible for the health and well-being of young people to really take seriously this notion of helping young people discover who they are rather than imposing our own expectations about who they should be. Kids will figure this stuff out if we create the space for them to do so. And I hope this conversation this evening helps make that so.
Wonderful. Thanks, Joel, for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Desiree.
You'll find links to Joel Baum and Gender Spectrum on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, where you can stay up to date on show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.